This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Recommender systems are something that most of us probably use all the time, even if you've never heard the term before or don't quite know what it means. So I'm going to start this talk just by explaining what recommender systems are and when we use them. Second, I'll say a little bit about my own research and what I do in recommender systems. Third, I'm going to talk about two of the most common technical solutions for how recommender systems are actually implemented on the web. So the kind of recommender systems you might be interacting with most frequently, how do they actually work? And fourth, time permitting, I'll talk about some of the open questions and maybe ethical problems that we might run into when we use recommender systems. Okay, so first of all, what is a recommender system? Like I said, we probably use them all the time, even if we don't know it. I mean, this is a very common form of recommender system. This is from Amazon. I had watched some movie, you can maybe guess what it might have been. And on the basis of that, they recommended that I might also like these types of movies as well. So these are some kind of action, comic book style films, all right? So they're recommending me other types of content that I might enjoy on the basis of what I've already consumed. Another type of recommender system, this is also from Amazon. It says, you know, you've watched Harry Potter 1, you might also watch Harry Potter 2, Harry Potter 3, Harry Potter 4, Harry Potter 5, Harry Potter 6, Harry Potter 7 Part 1, Harry Potter 7 Part 2. All right, you get the idea. And you can contrast those to the previous recommendations. These are sort of much more obvious, right? If you're watching Harry Potter 1, you probably already know that it's a film in a series and it has all of these sequels. So this recommender system is not really telling you anything that you didn't already know, but it still could be a useful recommender system. I mean, the purpose of this recommender system might be just part of Amazon's user interface. They know that the next film you're going to watch is likely to be Harry Potter 2, and all they're doing is surfacing that to a prominent location on their website's user interface, right? So they're just helping you use the website more efficiently. Also, again from Amazon, customers who bought this item also bought. That's another type of recommender system, which I'll explain how that works, which is just identifying substitutable or similar or complementary items, saying this shirt or these shoes somehow go with these jeans you're currently considering. This is another one from personalized playlist generation. You're listening to some music, you click thumbs up or thumbs down, depending on whether you like or dislike a song, and your playlist should be iteratively adapted to recommend songs that are more like or less like the one you've just listened to. Also, the advertisement you see here. This is probably the output of some kind of recommender system. So somehow a recommender system believes that this ad is contextually relevant to these songs that you're listening to right now. This is another recommender system. This is from Netflix. So this is an old Netflix user interface. They don't have this feature anymore, but they used to say, this is the star rating that we think you'll give this movie. So the important thing to note there is that's not the average rating the movie Mad Max has received. It's the rating they think you will give to this movie. So that's a kind of recommendation that might be useful to tell us whether we will personally like something. Maybe it will give us some more context we can use to decide what to watch. All right. Okay, and so far I've just talked about examples in like e-commerce. We see recommender systems all over the place, though. I mean, this is an example from email. Google's priority inbox says which emails are important. That's a kind of recommender system. Outside of the web, you see things like personalized health, where I'd like to estimate whether a particular medical intervention will have a certain effect on an individual. Or on social networks, when Facebook recommends people you might want to become friends with. Those are all examples of recommender systems, broadly speaking. In other words, the goal of these systems is always to predict how will a user or a person respond to some stimulus. Okay, that's what the recommender system is doing. It's predicting how will a user respond to something. Okay, so these are all the examples I've given of the kind of things recommender systems can do. So very broadly speaking, we're talking about modeling or predicting people's preferences, their opinions, and their behavior based on historical data about their past interactions. And the way I see recommender systems is kind of like this, and this will become maybe important later on. So I think of the recommender system as like a black box, which tries to make a prediction about how a person will respond to some stimulus. Okay, will they click on an ad? Will they purchase a product? How much will they pay for a product? Will they friend somebody on Facebook? Okay, these are all examples of predicting how a person will respond to a stimulus. You have some black box that can solve that problem. And then all of these applications are just different ways of using that kind of black box. Okay, they're kind of user interface decisions. Okay, so that's what recommender systems are. A little bit about my own research. So my lab tries to use these types of data to understand the dynamics of people's opinions and behavior. There was one really nice study we did about beer preferences and how people acquire taste for beers over time. And we show that, you know, as people drink more and more beers, they eventually develop a taste for IPAs. It's very San Diegan. It was good fun. We also look at linguistic dimensions of recommender systems and sentiment analysis. So this is an example also from a review of a beer as it happens, where we're trying to break down sentiment that people write into different sensory aspects. So we're trying to see if we can break down a beer review into aspects that describe the taste, the smell, the appearance, the feel, and the overall impression of a beer. Good fun. And something my lab has been doing more recently is to try and use recommender systems for design. So rather than having a recommender system that just predicts whether you will like or purchase a particular product, can we actually use the recommender system to say what products should be created? So this is an example where we're trying to build personalized designs of clothing items that a specific user would be likely to purchase. Okay. So in essence, the kind of research I do has these two goals. One is just to build more accurate predictive models of people's behavior based on historical data. And another goal is to try and gain insights into human behavior from such data. So technically speaking, the way to think about these two goals, the former is kind of what's called machine learning. We're building these predictive statistical systems that look at historical data in order to estimate what people do in the future. The second is what I call computational social science here, where we're actually trying to use that data to gain insights into why people behave the way they do. And I think this latter part is maybe what distinguishes sort of academic research on this topic, like what I do versus industrial research. So I'm not working for any company or anything to build better recommender systems or increase someone's bottom line. So, you know, don't blame me for harvesting all your data, or, you know, don't blame me because your Facebook is full of political content these days. All I'm trying to do is use those types of data sets, including from e-commerce and from businesses, to say, why do people behave the way they do? Okay, so on to some actual recommender systems and how do they work. This is the first example I'll describe. So this is the feature from Amazon, which is people who bought X also bought Y. Okay, so you're looking at a pair of jeans and they say you might also consider this shirt or this pair of shoes. So somehow they've made the determination that that shirt and those shoes are similar to this pair of jeans based on some features of the two items that make them similar, or otherwise perhaps the users who buy the jeans are similar to the users who buy that shirt. Okay, so how do they actually do that? All right, so our goal then is to come up with similarity measures between users, or similarity measures between items, to make that kind of recommendation. So how do we measure similarity between users? Well, maybe we can do that by looking at the items each user has purchased. And how do we measure similarity between items? Well, maybe we can do that by looking at the users who purchased those items. Okay, sort of makes sense. How does that work technically? I'm not going to bore you with mathematical equations or anything, but this is kind of what the algorithm sees in terms of data. And this is maybe the first thing that's surprising to people who've used these recommender systems and think, you know, they're so intelligent, they're making these, maybe you don't think that, but in making these very creative seeming recommendations. Well, this is really all they see about the data. They see this giant set of every single item from Amazon, every single user from Amazon, and then we build this matrix that has a 1 if they've purchased it and a 0 if they haven't purchased it. Okay? The algorithm has no clue whether, you know, this user is a female and this user is 45 and this is a pair of jeans and this is a pair of shorts. It has no idea. All it knows is for each user, there's some set of items they've purchased, and for each item, there's some set of users who has purchased it. Okay, and now to estimate similarity between two items, what's typically done is to compute this thing called the Jaccard coefficient. Again, don't worry too much about the mathematical equations, but you can easily explain this thing in terms of Venn diagrams, which hopefully are not too frightening. Okay, so I know I love Venn diagrams. All right, so we have two items, I and J, and we have sets of users who've purchased them. Users A who've purchased item I, users B who've purchased items J. And we say, well, those two items are similar to each other if they have a lot of users in common who've purchased them both, right? That's the intersection between those two sets. Okay, that's the first part of it. Now, where that's not going to work so well is if you have two very, very popular items, like you have, I don't know, AA batteries and Levi's jeans or something. Well, they've been purchased by tons of users, so they'll have a fairly large overlap, even though they're not really similar. So to correct for that, what we then do is divide by the total number of users who've purchased either item. Okay, so that's the union here. So that's going to discount for items that are extremely popular. So really what we're measuring then is just the overlap between these two sets. Okay, you have the set of users who purchased one item, set of users who purchased the other one, and you're going to get some value, which is between 0 and 1. So it'll be 0 if these two sets are completely disjoint, right up to 1 if the two sets completely overlap. Okay, and that's your measure of similarity between two items. Okay, and that really is, according to some fairly dated paper, how Amazon actually generated these types of recommendations. So they would take this item, they'd find all users who'd purchased it, do the same thing for every other item, compute those similarities, and then surface the items with the highest similarity. Okay, so that's customers who viewed X also viewed, and customers who bought X also bought. It's exactly the same thing, I'm just using different data. So in the former case, I'm looking at what did people click on in order to build that matrix or their sets of users. In the second case, I'm looking at what did people actually purchase in order to build that matrix or the set of users. And, you know, as simple as that sounds, that kind of leads to this natural notion of these items which people co-clicked roughly substitutable, and these items that people co-purchased are roughly complementary. But, you know, the algorithm doesn't know anything like that. It doesn't have any visual knowledge that says this shirt is in the same fashion style as these jeans or anything like that. Okay, so just to sort of summarize this part, we have a similarity measure between two items that takes values between 0 and 1 for unrelated to related items. We can measure similarity between users in exactly the same way in terms of the items those users have bought. And all these other features, like people who liked X also watched Y, you'll like X because you liked Y, all these things, they're all variants of basically the same technique. Okay, so we can adapt this notion of similarity to all of these ideas. Okay, and the two things that I think maybe are surprising or interesting about this model, the first, it's not personalized in any way. I'll get to personalized recommenders in a minute, but this model is going to generate the same recommendations for every single user. It doesn't know anything about you personally, other than the fact that you're viewing that original product. The second thing, which maybe is surprising, is that these systems really don't know anything about users or items. So people are often a little bit creeped out by the kind of recommendations they receive from recommender systems. Really, it's just discovering which users are similar to each other and which items are similar to each other. Maybe you're similar to another person who behaved a certain way, and that's why the algorithm is able to make these accurate predictions. But really, the algorithm has very little intelligence that it uses to solve this problem. Okay, so next thing I want to talk about is another type of recommender. This is actually a personalized recommender. So this is more like that one I described at the beginning, where Netflix is trying to estimate what rating would you give to that movie. So I'm trying to come up with a function that's given a user and a particular movie and estimates the rating that that user will give. Okay, so we need some kind of model of the user, what are their preferences, and some kind of model of the movie, what are its properties, and then I have to estimate whether those two things are compatible with each other. And then you can think, well, I can easily do recommendations with this model just by saying, what movies are you likely to give a high rating to? Okay, so this is kind of inspired by this competition that Netflix created, I guess, 13 years ago now. So they released this data set, this anonymized data set of 100 million movie ratings. The data set looked like this. We have a user ID, an item ID or a movie ID, a timestamp, and a rating. We have no clue who that user is. We have no clue what that movie is. It's an anonymized identifier for each user and for each movie. And then the goal was, don't worry about the equation, but the goal was to try and predict ratings as accurately as possible. You have to come up with a system that, given a user and an item, can estimate the rating. And all this equation says is your ratings that you predict should be as close as possible to the real ways that people actually rated these movies. Okay, and if you can come up with a solution that was 10% more accurate than Netflix's existing solution to this problem, you get $1 million. Okay, so that inspired a lot of research on machine learning solutions for this problem. There's lots more to say about that if people are interested. It also led to a nice lawsuit against Netflix for releasing this type of data. All kinds of questions about whether it's good value for Netflix to give away $1 million and then have hundreds of academics working for hundreds of hours on this. But, you know, those are questions for another time, perhaps. But anyway, it led to a lot of recommender systems that try and solve this type of predictive task, where we'd like to estimate a rating or some real valued quantity like a price given a user and item combination. So how is that normally done? So the data now looks like this. This is very similar to the data we had before. Before I said we'd have this giant matrix of every user on Amazon or every user on Netflix and every item on Netflix, and we'd have a 1 if they bought it and a 0 if they didn't. This time we have the same matrix, but now we have the star ratings. Okay, so this is given a user item combination, what is the rating that user gave to that item? Of course, most entries of this matrix are missing because most users have not watched most movies. Our goal is to then fill in the missing values. Okay, and how does the solution then work? I'll just sort of describe it very briefly and then give you a more intuitive notion. So, you know, I don't know if everyone remembers their linear algebra, but what we can do is take a giant matrix like this and represent it as the product of two smaller matrices. So we can take this matrix, which contains all users times all items, and represent it using a small matrix that has a small vector describing every user and another small matrix has another small vector describing every item. So I don't know, this is an idea that's maybe only familiar to you if you've done some linear algebra, but it's a very old-fashioned idea that has not come from recommender systems. It comes from, you know, signal processing and principal component analysis. We're trying to break down this very, very high-dimensional matrix into two low-dimensional components, one low-dimensional component that describes the user and one low-dimensional component that describes the item. Technical details aside, what we actually get out of this is a small vector or a few parameters describing each user and a small vector or a few parameters describing each item. So that's going to look something like this. We'll have a vector describing a user in some low-dimensional space, which somehow captures my preferences. So maybe I've represented each user in a three-dimensional space. You might imagine those dimensions could correspond to things like, how much do I like action? How much do I like special effects? How much do I like romance in a movie? And we also get a corresponding vector for each item, which then says, how much does this item exhibit action? How much does this item exhibit good special effects? How much does it have romance in it? Okay. And then if those two vectors are similar to each other or they point in the same direction, that means I'll give this movie a high rating. Okay, that would mean my preferences are compatible with the movie's properties. Okay, so this is just an algorithm that's going to discover what are the important dimensions that explain the way people rate things and what are the important dimensions of the movies. And then two users are similar to each other if they live nearby in this space, which means they care the same amount about special effects and action and romance. Two movies are similar if they live nearby in this space, and a user will like a movie if they have similar positions in the space. Okay, so their preferences are similar to the movie's properties. And that's really all that's going on. Okay, so people give high ratings if their preferences are similar to a movie's properties. So just to summarize this technique, each user and item is described by a vector representing preferences and properties. Users give high ratings when properties are similar to their preferences. Again, all the model is really doing is discovering dimensions that explain variance in the data. I mean, these things I said before, like action and special effects and romance, those are really just interpretations of those dimensions. The model is going to discover whatever are the important dimensions that explain most of the variance. If that's the movie's budget, it will discover that dimension. If that's a certain actor being in the movie, it will discover that dimension. Again, though, this kind of model knows nothing about the users and items. And you can sort of see that from the kind of data Netflix gave us. They didn't even tell us what the movies were. They didn't tell us if they were action. They didn't tell us if they had a large budget. They didn't tell us anything about the users. They just gave us a set of users, a set of items, and a set of ratings. And we had to automatically discover from that, well, there exists these latent dimensions within that data that explain why certain users are likely to rate certain movies a particular way. So it will discover that you like action movies, but it won't actually know that it's discovered that, if that makes sense. Okay, so what have I presented? I presented a couple of types of models. One which makes recommendations based on similarity between items, that's a non-personalized recommender. And the second, which is a personalized recommender, which makes recommendations by discovering a low-dimensional representation of each user and each item. And they both operate on the same type of data about user and item interactions. They both just have these matrices of users' interactions with items. They don't know anything about the users. They don't know anything about the items. And they're just discovering what are the common patterns or variants in this type of data that explain what the missing entries are likely to be. Okay, so you know these are sort of the basic approaches that you probably interacted with regularly. There's all kinds of extensions to these to incorporate things like temporal dynamics, context, social dynamics. You know, you'll rate things similarly to the way your friends rate things, and that can be used to improve predictions. Geography, text, image, audio data, expertise of users, all kinds of things like that. I mean, it's a big active topic of research to make these things more accurate by using all kinds of features. But generally speaking, we're talking about systems that learn from data of user-item interactions, and they're estimating some notion of similarity between users and items. And just to sort of say the moral of the story again, these systems, generally speaking, know very little about the users and items themselves, but are just looking for common patterns of behavior and making recommendations on that basis. Okay, so yeah, I mean, I came up with a few open questions. Basically, this kind of notion is what leads to things like the filter bubble when you're making recommendations that are purely based on similarity. I also had some other thought ideas about, you know, how much is this due to problems with the recommender system per se versus problems with the user interface that's built on top of a recommender system. Again, a recommender system is just a black box that makes predictions. So is it to blame for poor recommendations, or is it more of a UI or HCI question? I also raise this question of how much the users themselves are responsible for improving the quality of the recommendations they receive and the extent to which companies actually want to improve the quality of the recommendations they receive. And finally, this question about, you know, people find these systems creepy, but I think by doing so, people are actually imputing human intelligence onto sort of very simple statistical processes. Okay, so I think I'll leave it there and happy to hear your questions. Thanks.
So one of the issues that may be reflected in some of the questions we'll see is fears of what might be done with this kind of technology. And the place we need to start is what is realistically possible versus what is unlikely or unlikely within any foreseeable time. Can you give us a sense, you know, put some sort of boundaries on what we realistically can expect of this kind of approach with recommender systems? How deep can you expect it might dive? What are the limits? Where would you say, don't worry about that, because that's not going to happen?
I'm not sure if I would say don't worry. I mean, I think the way I describe these recommender systems, they sort of seem incredibly shallow in a way, because they're making these very simple inferences about who is similar to whom. But really, when you're talking about the kind of data that Amazon or Facebook or Google or anyone collects, they can make extremely accurate predictions about your future behavior based on even these fairly naive models, just because they have such a scale of data. They've seen people behave similarly to the way you're behaving and can therefore predict your behavior very accurately. Most of the time, it actually doesn't take huge leaps and extremely complex machine learning to make these sort of creepily accurate predictions. It really just takes having the right data and having these huge volumes of data. You know, I think we can already see some perceived and some actual negative things that recommender systems are doing, whether it's like the polarization of politics or something, or people collecting data from websites like Facebook in order to try and influence political campaigns. I think those are certainly legitimate fears, and they're things that are really happening. How much they're really the fault of the recommender system versus, you know, the recommender system being used nefariously or people using the data nefariously, it's maybe hard to say.
Well, that actually leads to the question I asked the audience, which is, what are their worst worries? Before going to what your worst fears are about how this kind of technology might be used, what's your perception of the costs and benefits of recommender systems existing? I mean, given that they're going to be there, how much do we get from those advantages as users? I mean, is it worth the risks that we are talking about?
I think so. I think people may not realize how dependent they are upon recommender systems, and they really are ubiquitous in all kinds of websites we use. I mean, even things like spam filtering or newsfeed ranking or something. I mean, email would be much less usable if not for the recommender systems on email clients. The Facebook feed, maybe it's not perfect, but it would probably be much worse if there were no algorithm guiding what content we're likely to enjoy. Same with Twitter. I mean, if you construe recommender systems much more broadly, when we think about things like personalized medicine, I mean, there the upside is much larger. We need models that can personalize interventions to individuals. You know, it's not just social media and e-commerce and online news. I mean, these things also have potential benefits in all kinds of fields, but we need to model individuals and make personalized interventions.
So like much of the technology we talk about in this series, there is tremendous benefit to be gained, and the question is, how do we manage what those risks might be? So what are the risks that are on your radar screen that you're worried about?
Yeah, I think there's two kinds of risk. There's kind of recommender systems can accidentally do bad things. I mean, if you think about the filter bubble, which I just mentioned very briefly, where you sort of end up with recommendations that all look exactly the same as each other, and maybe that leads you to seeing only political views that agree with your own or something like that. That's kind of a recommender system accidentally doing something bad. It's maybe solidifying people's opinions or narrowing people's horizons. That's kind of one dimension of risk. I think the other dimension of risk is recommender systems being deliberately misused, or the kind of data that recommender systems collect being deliberately misused. So we have very effective tools to predict how a person will respond to a certain stimulus, and you can see how this might be used to target individuals for a political campaign or something like that. I mean, that's exactly how recommender systems have been used, or allegedly have been used, to sort of target individuals on Facebook who might be susceptible to a certain view or something like that.
So if we could dig deeper on one of those, so for the worry about the bubble for news feeds, for example, if somebody came to you and said, I want you to design a better system for providing people with news feeds that will decrease the risk of them only seeing what they already believe and reinforcing that, what could you do? Like, what would, you know, sort of without the mathematical end of it, I mean, how would you try and design that?
I mean, that's an ongoing area of research. I think the most basic thing you want is to increase the diversity of the content that people see. I mean, you can see how these recommender systems that naively look at similarity are, of course, going to recommend many things that are very similar to each other. But you have a measure of similarity, so you can also recommend things that are less similar to each other. The other risk I would think exists there is that maybe companies know how to fix the filter bubble and they just don't really want to. Like, people often complain about, I'm getting all of these clickbait news recommendations. I think, well, maybe you'd get less clickbait news recommendations if you didn't click on all of them, right? So I think many companies that implement recommender systems, they know about the filter bubble, but it's working pretty well for them, right? People are seeing lots of the same content, but they're interacting with that content. I think another big challenge with recommender systems is that they're optimizing these very short-term goals. Like, I'm trying to predict, is a user going to click on this news article? And you can sort of see how that could lead to things like clickbait, right? Whereas it's very much more difficult to optimize a goal like, is this user going to remain subscribed to the New York Times in 2 years' time, right? So are they going to be happy long-term with the kind of recommendations they were receiving? That's the kind of thing that I would like to see optimized, and I could see would solve the filter bubble to some extent, but that's very difficult and sort of a very different type of optimization problem to what can be solved with this type of system.
So we have some of the answers from people, and it looks like a handful of people said they weren't worried, but the very first one raised a question that there are two distinct zones or domains we might talk about here. One is research, like what you're doing, to try and understand these systems. And the other is the application of those systems. There could be risks even in doing the research as you try and understand what might happen with this technology. There are things that you might do in terms of security issues, for example, collecting enough information about people, and that might get out. And you know, the worry, for example, with Netflix and their database being released. Well, let's take that question first, and I have another question about people you work with. But first, what do you do in your research, if anything, to protect the privacy of people whose information you've collected? Do you feel you don't need to because somebody else is taking care of that, or is there something you do that helps protect the users?
Yeah, I mean, mostly we don't use private information. I mean, I think this is a very broad question. It's like, well, if you think about something like security, which you mentioned, it's like, well, there's always this arms race between benign actors trying to understand these things better versus nefarious actors trying to understand these things better. And, you know, the knowledge that you gain can be used against you. Right. I think as an academic, I sort of have to feel comfortable on some level studying these things, even knowing that the results of those studies could be used nefariously. It's better to at least understand what's going on rather than not understanding what's going on, and then it sort of happens without you anticipating it. Maybe a slightly trite answer.
Yeah. Well, let me sort of zoom in on a specific question. So you might collect data on and be looking at data where it can clearly be mapped that specific users have chosen to have chicken delivered to their home to be eaten, not as a pet. And for most people, having that information revealed publicly, yes, wouldn't be a problem. But if you were a prominent member of an animal rights organization who argued against anybody eating chicken, then that might be something you wouldn't want compromised. So do you have any, how confident can we be that that could not be discovered from things that you do or the people that are providing you the data?
We couldn't be very confident. So if I can maybe take an aside and say what happened with Netflix. They released this data set, which I described, which is an anonymous user ID, an anonymous movie ID, a timestamp, and a rating. And somehow people figured out from this exactly what movies individual people watched. You think, well, how can you possibly do that? It's a completely anonymized data set. There's no usernames. There's no movie names. So what actually happened there was, some people, they rate movies on Netflix, and they also rate movies on IMDb. They're two websites with movie ratings. They'll include ratings on both of them. Okay, so they upload public ratings to IMDb, and the Netflix ratings they expect are private. So maybe they'll watch additional movies on Netflix they don't want you to know about. This could happen, right? So what actually happened was the researchers who de-anonymized this, they were able to find, there's a signature in the ratings you've given. So they look at the timestamps and they say, well, you've rated something 5, 2, 3, 3, 3, 5, 1, whatever. And I can find a similar signature in the anonymized Netflix data. And by doing that, I can discover, well, these two people are probably the same user. And once I've done that, I can figure out what the movies are. And then I can sort of iteratively do this until I've discovered all of the users and all of the movies. And lo and behold, yes, there's several users whose names we know because they have IMDb accounts. They've rated a bunch of movies on IMDb. And then there's other movies on Netflix they've also rated that they didn't want you to know about. And you can imagine what those might be. So that was sort of, it seemed like the most benign anonymized data set that you would be very safe releasing, or Netflix thought they were safe releasing, and I think they thought pretty carefully about this. And yet it was possible to de-anonymize this, and it contained very sensitive information. So I think we have to be very careful. I think you can never really be secure that a data set you've released is free of personal information. Of course, you go through IRBs and so forth at the university. For the most part, as academics, we don't actually have access to sort of private industrial data sets. We're using the kind of data that we can collect publicly, like publicly visible Amazon reviews, which I think is somewhat less risky than an anonymized data set, which one would release.
So actually, a quick aside on that. So you mentioned IRBs. So the kind of work you do, do you have to go through an IRB?
Only sometimes. I mean, like I said, I try to do things that are in, say, the medical domain, like personalized health interventions. That's something I really wanted to get into it as an assistant professor because it seems, you know, higher impact and more exciting than improving recommendations on Amazon. Yeah, but then again, you do have to spend multiple years going through IRBs, and then you get data sets that you can never release, and maybe it's harder for other people to follow up that kind of research. And, you know, personally, I felt that's maybe not such a good way to quickly advance machine learning technology. So in the end, I try to do research that doesn't require IRBs and is mostly concerned with publicly available non-sensitive data to the extent possible.
Yeah, and I apologize for those of you who don't know IRB. That's Institutional Review Board, and that's the committee that's responsible for reviewing any research that involves human subjects. So they try and make sure that, for example, there won't be a risk to privacy being compromised by the research.
And like you say, I've got to get tenure, so I can't wait for IRB.
So it's another conversation about why it doesn't move more quickly and how fast it does move, but that won't be the topic for tonight. So it's useful sometimes to take a step back. I mean, I'm looking at one of the questions, and some of these questions get to questions of fact about how these things are done. So in practice, to what extent, if any, are there time limits on how far back recommender systems look in terms of making connections? So specifically this said, for example, if I buy a book for a friend that I would not purchase for myself, will I get recommendations for that type of book indefinitely if I don't purchase another book of that type? And this, of course, would depend on the company and so on, but from what you understand.
The answer is probably it's going to factor in there somehow. Even though you don't like that book, well, maybe you like buying gifts for your friends, right? So, you know, you could buy something like that again. It's not impossible. Amazon does have a nice button, or they used to, that said, don't use this for recommendations. You know, if you want to get better recommendations, you can sometimes help companies out for what it's worth. Other than that, I mean, more broadly speaking, temporal dynamics are a huge component of recommender systems, one that I didn't talk about. But actually knowing like how old or how stale is the data is an incredibly important feature. At least it was for the winning solution to the Netflix prize. How do I discount old information was a huge thing. And there can be old information just due to, say, Netflix changes their user interface at one point and the rating scales have a different meaning. It's like, well, should I throw out the old data when that happens? Or should I keep the old data but weight it differently or interpret it a bit differently? And the main observation there was that, well, it's much better to use all of the data if we can, but to build a higher fidelity model that actually understands how relevant is the old data compared to the new data. We don't throw out old data, but we recognize that it is old, is the way you'd like to solve that problem.
So it's an important point about recommendations and how it works. So just, and you don't have to raise your hand if you don't want to on this, but if you are willing to, how many of you have used Amazon to make a purchase in the past? Okay, that's not surprising. Okay, and how many of you knew about the button you could click that says, don't use this for my recommendations? Okay, so you've had a tremendous impact this evening on a lot of people who now know about something they can use to adjust for their future. So this is a technical question that is perhaps a little bit out of what you primarily focus on, but you probably know the answer. How does my web browser track what I research and then transfer that info to ads on my computer phone's browser? So what are the connections that make that possible?
It's probably a little bit outside of my expertise, but there's various ways you can be tracked across multiple devices. If you're logging into the same services on many devices, if you log into Facebook on several devices or Google or Gmail on many devices, they will discover that you are the same individual, right? So Facebook can track you on websites that are not Facebook if that website has Facebook features built into it, like a like button, okay? So you can click like on a page and it's connected to your Facebook account, so Facebook knows that you have visited that page and they know that across multiple devices simultaneously. I mean, if you're using a Google phone or something like that, I mean, you're explicitly giving them permission to track a lot of this information. There's all kinds of other services that track you, like Google Analytics. I mean, anything that you're sort of logged into and you stay logged into can continue tracking you as you do other things. It is a little bit outside of my expertise, but that's my rough understanding.
But it's clearly there, and it actually relates to this idea of the extent to which we are being watched and monetized by taking what we do and turning that into something that can make money for these companies. And that leads to this next question, which I think may be somebody who watched an episode of Black Mirror. For those of you who don't know Black Mirror, you should look into it. The question is, how long before everything in my life is recorded as metadata?
I mean, maybe it's already happening. I don't know. I think things like your GPS location, I mean, everywhere you visit is increasingly being tracked. All of the websites you visit are increasingly being tracked. You can imagine soon all of the groceries you purchase and the food you put into your body will be tracked. I mean, these things are tracked through your credit cards as well. All of your transaction history is tracked. It's unclear how much of all this data is connected to each other, which is maybe the more important part of effectively using it. But I think, you know, I mean, it's already the case, unless you really make an effort for it not to be the case, that all of your activities on the web, anything that involves a purchase or using a mobile phone is already being tracked, probably being collected, maybe not yet being used, but it could be.
So actually, I want to step back from some of these questions now and something I was thinking about earlier, and that's you are a computer scientist. You're trained in computer science. Do you have any training in psychology? Okay. So it sounds like you're very interested, though, in what drives human behavior. Do you work with psychologists? And if not, are you interested in trying to be connected with some psychologists?
Yeah, possibly. I'd love to be. I mean, I think what this is maybe closer to is social science, which maybe is a bit more overlapping with psychology. I mean, this research is quite core computational social science, which is sort of a growing subfield of computer science. I think that has more of a connection to, say, psychology. So a lot of the research we actually do is sort of taking questions that a social scientist might traditionally have asked via, say, a survey. And, well, of course, with a survey, you collect very limited amount of data, but you collect data of very high quality. And if you compare that to, say, recommender systems data or users interactions with websites, you get huge amounts of data, which is generally of very low quality. So this research area is all about trying to perform social science type research using these sort of very large harvested data sets of user interactions. And I think, yeah, increasingly that ought to have connections to related fields like psychology.
Yeah, well, and I mean, what you described before sounded a lot more like economics. I mean, economists would be very interested in this, but I can imagine psychologists would perhaps, you know, at least identify some of the things one might want to be looking at for seeing what drives behavior, somebody's decision to choose a particular product or not. And so
yeah, I mean, I think also I should mention a challenge with this research is you generally don't have access to the users. You have some data that you've collected from the users, but you can't actually ask the user a question. Like, you can't say, why did you do this, the way a psychologist might more easily be able to.
Okay, so back to some of the questions. This is an interesting insight. I don't know the source, but let's go with it and see whether it resonates with you. I read an article that there were algorithms on Facebook that could, quote, know, end quote, you better than your best friend based on 30 likes. The method you described does not seem able to do that. Was that article untrue, or are there far more worrisome algorithms out there?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, the word know is the loaded word in that quote, perhaps. I mean, I think if you wanted to put it more precisely, I haven't seen this article, but I would imagine the statement, if you wanted to make it more soberly, would say Facebook can more accurately predict what you will like next if they've seen you like 30 things than your best friend would be able to, right? And that's more of a sober statistical predictive statement. In that case, I totally believe it, right? If Facebook has seen you like 30 things, they can build a very accurate model of what you will like and what you will dislike. Whereas, I mean, a human might know you a lot better on a personal level, but they don't they just can't make that same kind of statistical inference as accurately.
Well, that makes sense. The next question, I think I know the answer to, and it's pretty obvious, but maybe I'm missing something. The question is, how can we be sure that web-based businesses or sites aren't biasing the results of recommender systems to their benefit? And I'm thinking, why wouldn't they?
Yeah, I'm sure they are. I mean, they have a business interest in not just recommending to you things that you'll like, but things that you will pay a lot for. I mean, there could be two things you like equally and one of them generates less revenue. I imagine they're going to be recommending you the one that generates more revenue. I mean, you can certainly, there are these sort of famous cases of people seeing this kind of bias where they look at a flight website and it recommends a flight at a certain price and they come back later and the price has gone up. And then they look on a different computer for the same flight and the price is lower again, because basically they've been tracked and they're trying to inflate the price because they think you'll pay more if you think the seats are running out when they're not really. I mean, I think that's something very small you can do. You can say, well, if I try to look at the same, if I try to consider the same purchase from an anonymous user or from the perspective of a different person, is it going to recommend me the same thing? But otherwise, yes, I'm absolutely certain that websites are biasing the recommendations they make to you in various ways to suit their own interests.
Well, it just seems kind of self-evident that's what they're there to do. So I'm not sure what you could tell us that we haven't already thought of, but somebody did ask, how do these comparisons work on dating sites?
Oh, yeah. I mean, dating websites are absolutely very heavily driven by recommendation technology. You know, it's one of the most important problems you can solve. None of them give out their data, of course. But that is, it's a very similar type of problem. The only difference is we're trying to estimate how an individual will react to another individual. And you'd usually have some signal that you're trying to measure, like reciprocal communication. So will you contact somebody and will they contact you back? That's a signal we can try to predict given a pair of individuals. It's very traditional recommendation technology that drives that. I mean, the only differences are we're not considering a user and an item, we're considering a user and another user, and the feelings have to be reciprocated is one other issue. So the preference should go in both directions. The other thing that makes dating recommendation different from other recommendation is everyone has to be recommended to someone, and you know, vice versa, right? No matter how undateable you are, you still have to get recommendations. Like for movie recommendation, there can be movies that are good and there can be movies that are bad and just don't get recommended as much. For online dating, we have to solve what are called these marriage problems, which, you know, the name makes sense, where, you know, every user has to receive 5 recommendations and vice versa. So it's not just about saying, you know, this is the most dateable individual on the whole website, I'll recommend them to everyone. You obviously can't do that. You have this constraint that says anybody can be recommended to no more than a certain number of people, and you know, everybody can receive a certain number of recommendations.
So everybody gets a match is the point. It gets or matches.
Exactly. But I mean, other than that, the actual estimate of the compatibility between people is a fairly standard recommender system type of technology.
Okay. Question.
Thank you very much for your presentation, and sure. I'm very interested in what some of the social science questions you're currently interested in exploring in your new attempt at tenure.
Oh, sure, yeah. I mean, one of the ones we looked at a lot is, like, how do users acquire tastes for things? So how will your preferences change as a function of you just consuming more of the same item? And maybe we can actually, you know, generate sequences of recommendations around that idea. So if you want to get into classical music, maybe you don't listen to the most advanced classical composers. Or if you want to get into beer, you don't necessarily drink IPA right away. You need sort of the gateway beers or something like that. And you can think of sort of more useful applications of this technology, like curriculum design. If you want to learn about a topic, can I recommend a sequence of classes you could take to learn that most effectively? So that, you know, you'll exhibit high grades in the whole sequence of classes. Another thing I'm looking at a lot is things like bias in recommender systems. So There's a lot of interest these days in building machine learning algorithms that are kind of fair and are not subject to the same biases that exist in the historical data. So if you have, say, a predictive algorithm that makes initial hiring decisions, you receive thousands of CVs and you want to predict the top 100, and maybe your historical data exhibits a gender bias or something like that, can you actually build a recommender system or a predictive algorithm that says what are your top CVs but is not subject to the same kind of historical bias that your data exhibited? So this is something that I'm looking at, but it's also a very hot area in machine learning.
So this next question relates to a couple of things, because what I'm hearing from the audience, what I think a lot of us struggle with, is two things. One is almost a surprise when we see that something is showing up again and again in our feed, that we looked at a lamp on Amazon, and now that lamp, even though we decided it was just not the lamp we wanted, it keeps showing up again and again. And I'm not sure you have the answer to this. This might require a social scientist, but is this something that we will simply get used to? And the answer is probably yes, because it's, we've already chosen to use this technology knowing that we're going to get ads. I mean, that's something we're a trade-off we're going to make. And one could argue that then you get fewer different ads if they keep sending you ads for the same thing, and so maybe that's better. But I think we're worried about that sense that somebody's watching us, and that's probably what people are disturbed about here.
Sure. I mean, to go back to your first point about being shown the same thing over and over again, I think people may not realize, and maybe as a psychologist you have something to say about it too. It's like, well, sometimes it works, right? You're showing the same thing again and again and again, and you're not interested in it, and then one day you click on it. I mean, I know this certainly happens on YouTube, and this has been studied on YouTube as well. It's like you show people the same thing, eventually they just click on the recommendation. There's even a big part of YouTube recommendations is recommending you things you've already watched because you're going to watch them again. I mean, your preferences maybe come periodically or something like that. Same with advertisements. I mean, the advertiser knows you didn't click on the ad, but they still feel that it's worthwhile to them to show you the ad again. And there's some pretty reasonable technology behind that to know when you're genuinely not interested in the ad versus whether you just haven't been shown the stimulus enough. And eventually, if they sort of ram the ad onto you, that you will click on it. I think, again, people are somewhat to blame for responding to these ads that are being shown to them many times. It's like, well, if you didn't eventually click on it, it would eventually go away. As for the question about whether you're being watched, I mean, yes, you absolutely are being watched. I think all this data is really being collected, and it is being used for you and against you. Again, I would say it's maybe not watched is a loaded term. You're not being watched by an intelligence. Your data is being collected and harvested, and it is being used to generate recommendations or show you advertisements. It's not like there's some human behind the scenes who's individually looking at your data, of course. It's being watched by, intelligent or not, statistical algorithm.
Yeah, well, one moment to finish this. So it's true that there isn't a human per se who is making those decisions, but a human, perhaps with skills like yours, has developed an algorithm. Another human has chosen to apply that algorithm. And so it is humans behind that. I mean, it's not as if this is some random creation of code that's going to make these choices. So.
I think these algorithms can only guide our behavior so much. I think most of the time, these algorithms, even though humans are deciding how they're used, they're still being used to do things like, can I surface an ad you'll click on? Can I surface a product you'll pay a lot for? Can I surface a page on your Facebook feed that you'll like? These algorithms certainly are not at the stage where they're capable of leading you down very complex paths of behavior that are against your own free will, I don't think.
Yeah, well, that last part is, again, to the discussion you were just touching on, saying about people, if they see the ad again and again, may at some point click on it. I've heard a lot of discussion, this is not my expertise, but I've heard a lot of discussion about the idea that if people repeat something again and again, no matter how untrue, simply through the repetition, it begins to become truth for people out there. So I'm not entirely comfortable that
sure.
this isn't.
No, I think it's fair to say there is an extent to which recommended systems, whereas, you know, recommending ads to you or something, they are exploiting tricks of human psychology. And people may not know that they're doing that, and it is ever so slightly creepy for sure.
So lots more I could ask, but better, we've got a question.
So the better these systems get to know us, both socially and what we buy and everything else, might they start predicting if we're going to commit a crime? And might not the police decide to accuse somebody of having committed an unsolved crime based on how these systems know us? By the way, falsely accuse somebody? I mean, are we headed down that?
To some extent. I mean, certainly police precincts use data. Everyone uses data these days. They use historical data of where crimes are occurring and where crimes are likely to occur in order to allocate resources. I mean, I think that's maybe not too frightening. It's just they're making data in order, they're using data in order to allocate their resources more efficiently. I mean, that's very much already happening. There are maybe a bit more frightening is recommender systems are used or starting to be used in things like recidivism prediction. So a judge who has to give bail or not give bail might have to predict whether you're going to commit a crime if you're released on bail, right?
Or parole or...
Sure, yeah. And that is starting to be done in a data-driven way. It's like, well, are people who've committed crimes like yours, do they tend to be recidivists, right? Data is being used to make that kind of prediction. I think, you know, you have to... Is this scary or not? I don't know. I mean, what it has to be better than is the human judge who's already making perhaps flawed and biased decisions because they're hungry or they're tired. I mean, there's this classical research that says people make parole decisions differently before and after lunch, right?
But is it Big Brother?
Well, I mean, maybe I'd rather have a computer algorithm make that decision than a highly biased judge. So that's kind of the bar we'd like to beat is perhaps a flawed human, right? Or maybe the system should be helping the human to make a better decision rather than supplanting them, right?
Yeah. By the way, I presume you know this, but Philip K. Dick, Minority Report, made into a movie, is what you were describing. So there's a movie based on a story written by Philip K. Dick called Minority Report, and that's exactly what you just described. That's a recommendation, not based on an algorithm, but based on my flawed memory. So I think we're going to have to probably close things off there, and I want to thank the audience for their participation, really interesting discussion, and thank our speaker.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.